Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Inflation, recession, stagflation, just what the hell is going on? Hi there, and thanks for tuning in to another Real Vision podcast. So what the hell is going on? We all want to know. Here at Real Vision, we've debuted a special series called Global Recession, Is Everyone Wrong? We've called on the world's best experts, including Juliette DeClercq, David Rosenberg, Peter Zeihan, Pierre Andrian, and many more, to try and help us make sense of things. These real experts will be giving Real Vision members in-depth, long-form analysis on the real stuff that's happening. And best of all, you can get access to all 14 days of Global Recession, Is Everyone Wrong? For just $1. Yep, $1. So head over to realvision.com/globalrecession. That's realvision.com/globalrecession to join us on this epic two-week journey of discovery.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, May 11th. I'm Maggie Lake, and here with me is Darius Dow, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. And we are dealing with another choppy day, and you're going to see Ash Bennington's with us again, but we're going to wait to get to him. I want to start with Darius and the inflation data. And Darius, we're actually ending the U.S. session for equities, sort of heading into the lows again, which is pretty ugly looking. And the market seemed like it really had a really hard time deciding how to digest this CPI number, the monthly CPI number we got. What were you watching? What stood out to you?
Yeah, there's a couple things that stood out to me, and it's the same thing that's been standing out to me really for the past kind of 6 months, which is the annualized momentum of the time series and all the various key components of the time series continue to trend in an adverse manner as it relates to the Fed's reaction function and ultimately the market's response to that. I'll give you three quick numbers. 7.5%, that's the rate of the annualized rate of change, the three-month momentum in core services inflation. That's taken the baton from goods inflation, which slowed to 0.8% on an annualized basis. That's the fastest number we've seen since August of 1990. Number two, I give you sticky CPI. That accelerated to 4.9% year over year. Doesn't really matter. I don't care about the year over year. The three-month annualized barely slowed, only 10 basis points, still tracking at about 6.5%. And then median CPI slowed 20 basis points to 6.2%, just off an all-time high. So, you know, on an annualized basis, sticky CPI, median CPI, services, core services CPI, all the things that feed directly into core PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation metrics, are continuing to misbehave and run well above, orders of magnitude above the Fed's target.
This is terrible. This is terrible sounding, Darius, even though you made it sound nice. Talk to me about why equities didn't tank right out of the gate, though. That was interesting. They looked like they were, you know, we popped around for a while. Maybe the true sentiment is coming here at the end of the day, but it looked like somebody was trying to step in and stabilize this. Was it technical in nature? Were people really trying to decide, you know, what does this mean and sort of play out the scenario, you know, in terms of Fed policy? What did it feel like to you?
Yeah, I'll be frank. I don't feel anything. It's all math and it's all data. So the initial response to the print was really just the fact that it confirmed the anticipated slowdown. So that's positive, number one. We're now moving in the right direction as it relates to, helping the Fed take its foot off the brake. But then when you actually kind of dig through the math, through the numbers, you know, it's not like, you know, the data comes out, you know, already, you know, manipulated into annualized time series and momentum, et cetera. You know, folks like myself have to actually go in there and take the raw data and manipulate it. And I think once people like myself, you know, updated their models, updated the charts, it got worse throughout the day. And this is something we flagged heading into the week. You know, this week, it's very unusual to see such weakness in the equity market and have it still persist with an implied volatility discount. And what I mean by that is the sort of price, the implied volatility of 30-day, you know, or sort of near-term put options relative to near-recent volatility. That's been the case. That's been persistent all week, even though we've had such, you know, some big smackdowns from a price perspective. And it tells you that investors are very sanguine. They're very complacent about this report. And obviously, the report did not behave in that manner.
10-year yield rose above 3%, but turned right back around 2.91%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, look, this is the bond market is starting to sniff out. Really, and this is the first week we've really seen this price action. The bond market is starting to sniff out the transition from what we call inflation. That's where growth is decelerating and inflation is accelerating, to where what we call deflation. That's where both growth and inflation are decelerating. You typically have both are risk off, but from the perspective of asset markets, but you typically have risk off and sort of inverse covariance between stocks and bonds in the latter regime. And so we're on the precipice of that. And ultimately, the bond market is actually looking forward to the Fed keeping its foot on the brake for longer, slowing the economy faster, and potentially transitioning from a soft-ish landing, to quote my friend JP last week, to something that looks like a not-so-soft landing. And ultimately, I think we're headed for something that may look like a hard landing if the data continues to behave the way it's currently behaving.
Yeah, and I heard a lot of people saying that this inflation read made that soft landing, which is hard anyway, and the Fed has a terrible track record, at it even harder now. I mean, it seemed to reduce the likelihood of that. Would you agree?
Yeah, one quick stat for you. I got this from either Lisa Shalit at Morgan Stanley or Kathy Jones at Schwab. I figured I was listening to. My apologies to both of you. The Fed is of the 14 tightening cycles we've had in the post-war era, 11 of them have ended in recession.
Yeah.
And the last time we've seen a soft landing, got to go all the way back nearly, you know, 25, 30 years to 94. Employment rate was 6.5% at the beginning of that hiking cycle. Employment rate was 10.5% at the beginning of the 84 tightening cycle, where those were the last two soft landings. We started this tightening cycle at a 3 handle on the unemployment rate. It's a pipe dream. It was a pipe dream at best to think that we were going to get a soft landing. And I think the data, which is what we specialize in at 42 Macro, analyzing and projecting the data. The data continues to tell us that the probability is actually shrinking, not improving.
Yeah, I want to bring Ash in. We're dealing with volatility, a big story developing on inflation. At the same time, layered on that, Ash, we continue to see this story about terror kind of reverberate through the crypto community. What's the latest there?
Yeah, we sure do. The latest is that Terra is an ecosystem. There are multiple parts of it. We'll talk a little bit about that. But here's your headline, which is Terra USD, sometimes called UST. This is a so-called algorithmic stablecoin. The peg has broken. The price has blown out. It's extremely volatile. This was trading as low as 30 cents on the dollar earlier. Looks like now we're up a little bit, about 66 cents on the dollar. But this is supposed to remain pegged at $1. So any decline on this that goes below, that breaks the buck, is considered a significant and, in fact, ugly event.
Yeah. So Ash, why is it such a big deal, right? Because we know there are all these different coins and, you know, for a lot of people who may be listening, you know, they might have a little money in some of them, probably most of it's in Bitcoin or ETH, but this just seemed like some of the headlines and articles that we're reading, you know, there's a grave level of concern. Why is this a bigger deal than maybe just that particular stable coin?
Yeah, that's really the key question that you just hit on there, Maggie. And the answer is because this is meant to be pegged. This is meant to be fixed. And it shows that there are weaknesses potentially in the market. I mentioned this yesterday. I think it was trading at about 90 cents when I said that it was a science experiment and the test tubes were blowing up. Sometimes you just get lucky. But look, the reality here is there is fear of liquidation of Bitcoin. Now, to date, we haven't seen anything that looks catastrophic in Bitcoin. I'm looking right now on my monitor, 29,311 on Bitcoin. If you look at that over a one-day chart, yeah, it's down about, call it 6.5% on a price basis. Reality is this is a very volatile asset class, 6.5%, not catastrophic. But the fear is that there might have been some liquidation to cover the cost, essentially to try and rebalance this peg. We haven't seen panic selling yet in Bitcoin, but it is something that, of course, we are watching.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it begs the question, it has to, whether you were talking about something happening in the crypto world, if it was a fund blowing up in the traditional finance world, we would be saying, well, if it happened to them, who next? Could it be someone else next? And what does that mean? That's always the fear, isn't it? The contagion fear. And I know that in some of the articles we've been sharing around, people are bringing this up, asking, is this crypto's Lehman moment? Is it their Bear Stearns moment? And I know there are very strong opinions on both sides of that, but that's sort of the level of discussion that's happening, at least in some places. What about regulators? I mean, they've got to be seeing this. What are we seeing on that front?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is something that Janet Yellen brought up in testimony before the Senate Banking Committee yesterday. We're hearing rumblings out of the European regulators that there's potential regulation around stablecoins. I was just hitting those headlines coming in. What's coming out of Europe sounds much more expansive in terms of the regulatory push that we might be seeing in the euro area, indeed in the EU, in terms of the push to regulate stablecoins. Look, ultimately, I suspect that we do get some regulation because, look, these really look like, look, feel, smell, taste like banking products, right? Mm-hmm. If you're depositing something and you're expecting to get it back at par, that sounds a lot like a banking product. Very often, some of the yield farming products look like the attempt at generating interest-bearing accounts. I suspect that we are going to see regulators, just not a prediction, but this is something to look for, looking to regulators to say, hey, look, if you're creating things that look like banking products, they feel like banking products, why aren't they being regulated like banking products? Not saying I agree or disagree, but I think that is the direction that this is going, Maggie.
Yeah, and the question will be, is that accelerated? Is that conversation accelerated now that we see what's going on? We have seen a little bit of spillover because we know some fintech names, some exposure to blockchain have been down. Coinbase has been getting hit. They've had to come out. And they came out with an interesting headline as well, didn't they, about people who have accounts. I mean, what do we know there?
Yeah. So basically this story that was a statement by Coinbase saying in the event of a bankruptcy, the customers may become general creditors. That is not something you want to hear if you're a customer. If you are a customer of a traditional broker dealer, there's something called SIPC. There's protection in the case of insolvency of the broker dealer, and you get your money back for the securities. Effectively, the statement, at least as I read it, as people I think are talking about it and thinking about it, is the fear that people who have their accounts may become general creditors in a bankruptcy proceeding. That's something that nobody ever wants to hear.
Right. And again, we'll no doubt spark that conversation around regulation. So much developing on this story. And I think it's so important. Ash, you're going to be doing a Twitter Spaces at 4:30 at the bottom of the hour, all about this, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's going to be the deep dive. That's going to be the nerd fest. We've got Jim Bianco, Santiago Velez, and Mike Rogers, who are scheduled to join us at 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, immediately following the conclusion of Real Vision Daily Briefing today, Maggie.
All right, fantastic. So if any of you have crypto in your portfolio, if it's something you're watching, something you're concerned about, as soon as we wrap up here, you can pop over to Twitter and check that out with Ash. Ash, thank you for popping in again. Appreciate it. And we know you're going to be all over this.
Thanks, Maggie. And come in and say hello, everyone.
I'm definitely going to join you, man. This is the biggest story on the tape right now.
Darius, you're welcome as well. Appreciate you too, Maggie.
Yeah, I will. Thanks, Ash. Appreciate it. All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So. So we got to dive back in here because, Darius, I think this, you know, this is, these things tend to happen when it's not helpful, when it's already a volatile situation. People are already getting killed on other things in their portfolio. And then you see this area that, you know, people were feeling good about, there was innovation, and now something like this happens. I mean, is that just going to sort of feed into the feeling of uncertainty? Are you worried about contagion spillover?
No, I wouldn't say worried. We're sitting pretty here at 42 macro from a portfolio construction perspective, but I am concerned about the spillover to broader financial markets from just investors taking their ball and going home. We've seen this in the active management community gearing up for this sort of slowdown. You're seeing it. You saw it in the sector and style factor dispersion for months. Defensive. Very clear indication that, you know, hedge funds and active managers in the mutual fund space were effectively gearing up for this kind of behavior. And I'm not sure that the average investor, unfortunately, in the digital asset ecosystem space really had a process to see this coming. And it's not that you can, you know, predict these sort of one-off events with the Coinbase, you know, taking out everyone's money and going bankrupt potentially, or breaking the bucket, Tether and Luna and all that stuff. It's hard to understand this, but what you do know is when growth is slowing and financial market volatility is high, this is where you start to uncover the bodies. This is when the bodies start washing to the shore. And so we're going to see more of this. We are not yet at the point in the growth and liquidity cycle where it makes sense for large scale capital allocation into these types of assets, into these types of products. And so the likelihood that we actually see more sloppiness, more negative headlines, more volatility is high over the medium term.
Yeah. And that is the worry. We've got some great questions. Casey, Paul, Machio, Jojo in the house. I'm going to get to them all in a second, but I wanted to run a little clip. As you know, we've been having the global recession series. Raul spoke to Gene Munster, head of research at Loop, about the outlook for technology. And this is, I was really interested to hear this because Gene, for those who don't know him, is a longtime technology watcher, very familiar with managements, you know, across this space. And they were talking about, you know, this sort of pull and push between some of the short-term pain we're seeing and some of the more longer-term trends they believe are still intact. Let's have a listen to the clip.
You have to take into effect the macro. And it's not my violin concerto, but I have to take into effect. And I would just maybe draw a line between unapologetically just supporting these tech growth companies, no matter how much they're down. That has not been our approach over the last 6 months at Loop. We've been pretty heavy in cash. We were 70% in cash coming into the beginning of this year. Now we're 50% in cash. And so we have, we've put money to work, and that money has, that has not.
Hold on. What made you go 70% cash? Because that's a hell of a ballsy call.
It was. It just, it felt like things weren't lining up. There was aspects that we saw and somehow these stocks were moving that reminded me of what happened around 2000, 2001. And it felt like we were in a bubble. And I would just describe it as that companies were just not going up. The valuations weren't going up in lockstep to what was changing the fundamentals. And we have a process called reverse DCF, where we basically calculate what is implied in the growth rate for these companies. And what we are finding is that many of these companies, that many of these tech companies were trading at valuations that would imply 40, 50% growth for the next decade. And the probability of that actually happening, that, you know, usually there's like 10 companies in tech out of the 3,000 tech companies, 10 of them that actually achieve that. But in this case, we had 100 plus type of those companies that were out there. And so that's what got us there, was this kind of I would describe it as a view of the future, but a discipline around valuation. And it was, by the way, it did not go well at first.
No, this is one of these career moves. If you're not careful and you get that wrong, you're going to get fired. And if you get it right, you're a hero, well, until they forget, which they always do.
And you can see that full interview on our website and as part of the series as well. Darius, being disciplined about valuation in tech, that wasn't something we were seeing a lot of, as Gene points out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a great chart on sort of quantifying valuation from a macro investor's perspective, because I don't necessarily disagree with the longer term conclusions. Although I will say that we are not yet at that point in the process where valuation should be a motivating factor for making new capital allocation decisions. So, Brian, if you don't mind putting up that chart, financial conditions, It's the title of the chart, Financial Conditions Remain Uncomfortably Loose. And here's why. The red line in this chart shows the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index without sort of, you know, regurgitating their white paper. It's really just a deviation of all the things that matter from a sort of a capitalization standpoint, if you think about companies trying to raise money. So, you know, what's the deviation in the dollar, credit spread, the earnings yield, or, you know, cost of capital, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's sort of inverse. It's correlated to volatility. It's inversely correlated to the price of the stock market, price of crypto, et cetera. Right now, at the current level, you know, we are as loose from a financial conditions perspective, meaning the Fed is still as easy as we were at the peak of the dot-com bubble. And so we haven't seen anything yet as it relates to the ultimate amount of financial tightening we need to see before the Fed is comfortable that it's done enough of a done enough damage to the markets and the economy to tame inflation. The black line in this chart shows the S&P 500's earnings yield, next 12 months earnings yield. So what's the analyst estimate, the consensus estimate for earnings for the market, and then sort of divide that by the price of the market. And as you can see, we're kind of right around where we are. And from a financial conditions standpoint, we're nowhere where we were, you know, kind of at the peak, you know, in terms of the peak earnings yield, the peak, the kind of the peak cheapness, the peak valuation of the market relative to the last sort of non-recessionary slowdowns. The last two we got were 2015, 16, and 2018. You know, you just look at the levels of where those dotted lines are. We have a long way to go to get to a place where the Fed is panicking about financial markets. And so this to me is why I say they remain uncomfortably loose, because there's, you know, there's kind of a gap between where we are today to where the Fed might feel comfortable pivoting even in the face of high inflation data.
Mike Dean, Adam, FRTC, welcome to the conversation. Let's get through some of these questions, Darius, because they're coming in pretty fast and furious. Casey from The Exchange, I've been looking at food as a proxy to especially gold, because you can't eat gold and banks don't want gold to go up. What outperforms during a monetary crisis that is also a food crisis? Is it food or assets like gold? Also, it sounds like another way to look for a safe haven.
Yeah, no, the number one asset to that outperforms in crises is cash. Yeah. You know, let's be totally honest with you, right? Like gold, if you pull up a chart of gold, it looks like it's trying to break down technically. It's becoming a source of funds because it's done well in the last, you know, year or so, and it's been relatively sort of low beta versus a lot of other higher beta risk assets in investor portfolios. I mean, just kind of, you know, not even going back to the chart, but just, you know, we're coming off an all-time low in the financial conditions index and an all-time low in the S&P 500's next 12-month earning yield, which means we were as easy as we've ever been from a Fed policy standpoint. And as a result, markets were as expensive as they've ever been as a function of how easy we were. And so we're all, not we, but a lot of investors are currently looking at price action like today, and they're panicking and saying, okay, either, you know, when do I buy or how much do I need to sell? And the reality is, we're just not close. You know, we're just, you got to understand where we are in the growth and inflation cycles in order to anticipate inflections in the liquidity cycle. And according to our analysis, we're at least a quarter away before the Fed can credibly pivot to being dovish, if not two or three.
Wow. So Mudshir is asking on The Exchange, do you see the market hitting all-time highs this year, early part of next year? If yes, what do you think the catalyst will be to drive the market up? Because everywhere, everyone is bearish. Isn't that contrarian?
Yeah, probably sometime next year we'll hit all-time highs. But here's the problem with even the Fed pivot today. If the Fed were to stop hiking interest rates, pause on their quantitative tightening program before it even began, might I add, you know, what's likely to happen is that you're going to get a valuation premium baked back into most assets. You're going to see, you know, sort of earnings at this, the earnings yield go down. You're going to see multiples expand, et cetera, et cetera. But then we're still going to get to a place where we have a lot of accumulated slowing to do. If you look at the three standard deviation shocks we've seen to the upside in real yields, the three standard deviation shock we've seen to the upside in mortgage rates, the three standard deviation shock we've seen to the upside in corporate borrowing costs when you look at the Bloomberg Barclays Index. And so we're going to slow economically no matter what the Fed does, over the next kind of 6 to 9 months. And the reality is just based on where unit labor costs are trending, you know, the 40-year high in unit labor cost inflation, 40-year low in productivity, it's suggestive that we're probably heading for an earnings recession anyway. I'm not saying that's the modal outcome, but I definitely believe it's a, you know, more than a 1/3 probability of occurring over the next, you know, several quarters. And so once you get that valuation premium, you got to look around and say, okay, who's the fundamentalist that's going to say this is an appropriate point in time in the cycle to be taking speculative risks? And I still think it's too early for that.
Yeah, it's very hard. People are, even if long term, you could hear the kind of battle because people are looking at some things that look interesting, but just sort of dealing with the market conditions right now seems difficult. To that point, Jojo on the RV side asking, should I add short PSQSH here? In other words, short ETFs.
I don't know what PSQEH is.
I think it's a short ETF for the QQQ and a short ETF for the S&P 500.
Gotcha. So without, you know, giving specific investment advice to the individual, I think if you have the ability to short, and this was part of the opportunity set we flagged to subscribers this week, the lack of an implied volatility premium in a week like this, or i.e. an implied volatility discount, tells you that the demand for near-term downside protection just wasn't there. But obviously, we're seeing a lot of near-term downside in markets. And so, you know, vol products have been generally cheap throughout this entire decline we've seen year to date. And part of the reason for that is, as I mentioned, you know, active managers, hedge funds, mutual funds have really shrunk the amount of risk that they're taking to the extent that they can do that. And so they just don't need the need to hedge is lower from that community. But it's certainly, I would argue, probably rising in terms of the need to hedge for the passive investment community or the community of investors that's only levered long one asset class or a series of assets within an asset class. That's a problem.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Dean from the RV site, dollar question. This is important. This is interesting too. If the dollar is soaring, but stocks and bonds are both going down, where are the funds entering the country going? Isn't this unusual? I've heard some people say when we're talking stocks and bonds, which we tend to do when we're kind of earmarking what happened in the markets, the dollar has been the real story, hasn't it? It's been relentless.
Yeah. So the funds entering the country can be going to pay back debt. I mean, it's not just investors who are controlling the price of the dollar through portfolio funds. It could be companies repatriating dollars from the rest of the world and looking around and saying, hey, this is a scenario that's actually getting worse. Let me bring my money home. If I've generated profits in Europe or generated profits in Asia, you know, now let me repatriate those profits so that, you know, the strength in the dollar, the trending strength in the dollar don't, you know, doesn't erode that any more than it already has. And so there's all these sort of funky dynamics in currencies that you never want to get to the place where you're isolating one variable over another, like interest rate spreads, et cetera.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean all those dollars are entering the U.S. and being invested here as well.
It's transitioning from bank A to bank B in a different
exactly.
soil.
Exactly. Dean, if you're interested, go on the site and check out the last conversation, or really any of them I had with Jeff Snyder. He talks a lot about the euro dollar market and the sort of rush for collateral and U.S. dollar holdings all around the world. It's dense, but super worth it. So I encourage you to go check that out if you want a little bit more information on that topic.
The whole world is structurally short dollars. There's about there's 13 or 14 trillion of dollar denominated debt outstanding that's not held by, or that's not been issued by U.S. domiciled issuers. And there's a structural sort of $1.5 to $2 trillion of dollar denominated debt that they have to roll over, that they're short, that they sort of finance themselves in shorter term paper markets, which is something that Jeff Snyder is a specialist on. So definitely go check that out. He's been one of the thought leaders in this subject.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons that they don't have a lot of confidence in central bank being able to do anything about it, because they don't control this huge shadow banking system of these overseas dollars.
No one does.
Exactly. Exactly. I joke with Jeff every time I talk to him. It's like, you know, the Matrix, where I'm like entering an alternate world and wondering why I didn't know more about it beforehand. But so good stuff for all of you who want more on that. Adam from Red Bank. Are we looking to buy bonds on dips now? If so, what durations do you like?
Yeah, absolutely. So not absolutely that we're looking to buy bonds on dips now. We're certainly in the process of evaluating whether or not we can start to allocate to duration. And there's a few things that we're looking for specifically to give us the all clear signal on that. Number one, we want to see the momentum of the time series, particularly for the inflation statistics that are correlated to core PCE, like sticky CPI, like median CPI. We want to see that momentum actually break down below the year over year, because that'll give us and the Fed confidence that the time series is likely to decelerate at a meaningful pace. Obviously, we did not get that in the today's CPI data. Number two, we want to see the inflation momentum, and particularly the inflation surprise in Europe, start to dissipate. This is something that we talked about in our macro scouting report yesterday. You know, the inflation surprise to the upside in Europe, as measured by the Citi Inflation Surprise Index, is several orders of magnitude higher than what we've experienced in the U.S. And as a function of that, we've seen a much more sort of forceful move higher in bond yields in Europe, and that, you know, continues to go unabated. And so that's part of one of the reasons we're seeing such weakness in the Treasury market, is because you've had a significant repricing in duration risk across the pond. And obviously all these things are correlated. The same insurers, pension funds, et cetera, are investing in all these types of securities on a currency hedge basis. And then lastly, we want to start to see it in the market. Right now, we probably have of the 42 market signals in our global macro risk matrix that we use to now cast the market regime, about half of them are about a fixed income or sort of could be a fixed income type securities or expressions. And nothing thus far is signaling that we're finally getting to a place where it's safe to buy bonds. We're waiting on one of those key markets to signal to give us the all clear signal. So definitely stay tuned for that.
Tim from Long Island on the RV site, VIX down pretty big or on a pretty big down day. Does it mean anything? Thoughts?
Yeah, no, it means that the demand for volatility products is low, because the people who would typically demand those types of products and take advantage of them, hedge funds in particular, have taken their ball and gone home. And this is the problem, right? And this is probably a story for another longer form discussion. This flow of funds into passive securities, passive investment exposures, I think it's somewhere around $1.9 trillion last year, which is more than the last 20 years combined or something like that. Don't quote me on that specific number, but it's a very big number. I remember that it's more than the last 20 years combined. You have so many investors who are basically making a quote-unquote passive bet, but it's not passive. It's an actively managed bet that the Federal Reserve is going to continue expanding its balance sheet alongside the balance sheet of every global central bank in the world. Brian, if you pull up this chart before we go, global liquidity. That chart, global liquidity, just shows the blue line shows the G5 central bank balance sheet on trillions of dollars. It's somewhere around $31 trillion now. The red line shows the global equity market cap. So it's US, China, Japan, Europe, et cetera, in trillions of dollars. And tell me if that's not the same chart. You know, this is going back to 2009, looking at this chart. And so it's telling you, if you're a passive investor, you're making an actively managed decision that the blue line is going to continue higher. And the rest of us who are actively managed investors, who are thoughtful in thinking about the cycle, understand that that blue line has to go down, certainly in dollar terms, for the foreseeable future, at least in terms of the forecastable future. And so that's an issue.
Yeah. Amazing stuff as usual, Darius. I just want to point out to FRTC, there's Mike, I think, from YouTube, a few different questions on crypto. Not sure if you were in the show when Ash was on a little bit earlier, but Ash is kicking off at Twitter Spaces right now as we speak, and they're going to do a deep dive into everything happening there around there and implications for the rest of the market around the Terra stablecoin UST. So I encourage you to go over there and check it out and post some of your questions. I think they might find an answer there, because we're out of time. But Darius, always great to catch up with you. Thank you so much. These are really hard markets to navigate, so hopefully people are, you know, getting some sort of sound advice and guidance on what to think about. And your point about, you know, being in a passive fund or being passive about it is a managed decision, I think, is a really, really important one to think about right now. You can't just close your eyes. You got to try to sort of understand what's happening and protect yourself as best as possible. So we appreciate it, as always.
course. Can I make one final comment
sure.
before we go? Yeah, absolutely. So I heard, I want to say George Noble, great Twitter. Go check him out on Twitter. He made a great comment in a podcast I was listening to recently. He said, you know, what's a stock that's down 90%? It's a stock that was down 80% and got cut in half from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the percentage change math is always not, is never working in your favor when you start suffering drawdowns. And so, you know, rather than sort of, you know, I know I probably sound a little bit excited and heated up, but what I really want people to take away from these discussions, and I'm going to be every Wednesday to help everyone through this bear market, is you always have an opportunity to realign your portfolio for the next probable outcome. You don't want to ever just sit there and say, well, I'm down 40%, I'm just going to ride it out, because you can be down 50% from that 40% to get to down 50, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? And so this is my I want everyone to understand that, hey, look, you always have an opportunity to make a better decision than the one you came into today with. And that's what we call next play at 42 Macro.
Right. And there's that old chestnut that you make cents on the way up and lose dollars on the way down too, right? It's hard to recover from those really big drawdowns. So, you know, all of those lessons hard learned by people who've been doing it have experience, been doing it for years. We should be paying attention to right now. So Darius, appreciate you helping us do that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, we're going to go try to hop on Ash's Twitter Spaces. Thanks again for watching the Daily Briefing. And Ash will be back tomorrow with Imran Laka. So be sure to join for that. Take care and good luck out there.
Cheers.
It's a really complicated world out there. We've got massive inflation, recession fears, war in Europe, COVID, China issues. What the hell's happening? Everyone's got an opinion. But who's right? Who's wrong? As co-founder of Real Vision, I've got my own view, but maybe I'm wrong too. And I want to go and find out more from real experts, real in-depth analysis. And I've hand-chosen my experts for this two-week journey of discovery in global recession. Is everyone wrong? I've chosen people like Peter Zeihan to talk to him about geopolitics, David Rosenberg about the economy, and Pierre Andrin, the world's most famous energy trader, about how to navigate the oil markets and where it's all going. This starts on May the 2nd, and I'm going to learn so much about what really is going on and how to best navigate it. Yes, not everybody's going to be saying the same thing, but it's going to allow me to piece together an investment framework to navigate these complicated times. Now, normally we'd give you 7-day trial for $1, but because this is so important for all of you, and I think it's one of the most important pieces of content we've ever done, we're extending that free trial for 2 weeks for $1. So you get the entire campaign of all of these great minds. And it's only $1 for all of this. So just go to realvision.com/globalrecession to find out more and join me as I try and figure out what the hell's going on.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.